Okay, while it is still 10 a.m., I will call this meeting to order. Carrie, will you please take roll?
Chair Brooks.
Here.
Vice Chair Ariscotta.
Here.
Regent Boylan.
Present.
Regent Brager.
Here.
Regent Brown is connected by Zoom. Regent Carvalho.
Here.
Regent Cruz Crawford.
Here.
Regent Del Carlo.
Here.
Regent Downs.
Here.
Regent Goodman.
Here.
Regent McMichael.
Here.
Regent Perkins. Regent Perkins. Regent Tarkanian.
Here.
You have a quorum present.
Thank you. You know, I think this morning I'm going to ask Interim Chancellor Patty Charlton to please lead us in the pledge. Thank you. And I certainly want to acknowledge Special Counsel Michael Wixom, who's with us today to help us out with anything that pertains to open meeting law. Thank you, Mr. Wixom, for being here. We appreciate it. I will now move to agenda item number one, which will be our public comment. For those who would like to call in and offer public comment, please dial 669-444-9171. And enter meeting ID 928-4944-5069 and passcode 555555. Is there any public comment at GBC?
No, there's no one here.
Thank you. Is there any public comment at the system office in Reno?
There is.
Yes.
Good morning. I'm Jim New, NEW, President of the Nevada Faculty Alliance. Today you will hear a report from a committee formed by the Chancellor to make recommendations on cost of living adjustments for NCHE professional employees in the next fiscal year. On behalf of NFA, I'd like to say thank you to the committee members for taking on this challenging task. We understand and appreciate the budgetary obstacles that must be overcome to implement salary adjustments that match the other state employees, including our classified colleagues who work side by side with us. These obstacles are significant, but they are not insurmountable. NFA has offered suggestions to the committee members and shared those same suggestions with you, the members of this board, for options that lead to the full 11% adjustment in FY25. We stand ready to discuss options that are responsive to the needs of faculty without crippling institutional budgets. We shared an analysis with you, and while it may not be perfect due to the level of detail that is available to us, we believe it demonstrates there is capacity within the system to absorb these adjustments. We hope you will take a few moments to read it and consider it. As you've heard me say before, NCHE faculty make the same sacrifices as the other state employees during periods of austerity, and we deserve to make the same recovery. And one last item, at the last Regents meeting, I pointed out that the salary schedule adjustment implemented in July 22 failed to make any adjustments to the salary schedules for community college faculty. Whether this was an oversight or simply a flawed methodology is immaterial. The community college schedule was adopted over 10 years ago, and it hasn't been adjusted once. It's time for that to be corrected. Thank you.
For the record, Garian Casale, CASALE. Good morning, Regents. I'm speaking today on behalf of the System Administration Faculty Senate. A memo regarding the 2024 Nevada Regents Awards was sent out to all ENSHE institutions, but not all institutions could apply for those awards. We know that the Regents hold all ENSHE institutions equally, so we think you'll find the following proposal in line with your values. The System Faculty Senate requests that the language of Title IV, Chapter 1, Section 18 of the handbook be changed to include all ENSHE institutions, as well as system administration itself. Why include system administration? We have researchers, too. The following quote comes to us from Dr. Scotty Strachan, the principal research engineer at System Computing Services. Research-related activities have become a more prominent part of ENSHE institutions over the last few years. Federal funding opportunities are becoming increasingly inclusive and targeted at STEM educators in both graduate degree-granting institutions as well as 2 to 4 year schools and underserved communities. Recognizing and supporting this tighter integration in between research and education would have long-term value and incentive for Nevada System of Higher Education institutions and faculty members. We have two recommendations. One, that the regents consider nominations for research-related awards across all ENSHE organizations. And two, that the regents also create a research award category for educators at ENSHE's 2 to 4 year institutions where, in spite of their heavy teaching loads and teaching-centric administrative support, a growing number of faculty members are successfully integrating their research interests into their classroom curricula. This exposes students to real-life applications of the course material, frequently connects them with scientists out of the labs, universities, and agencies, and can be a competitive edge for producing job-ready skills. Both Dr. Strachan and other researchers have not had the opportunity to receive recognition have secured millions of dollars in grants in their efforts to meet the system's strategic goals. Let's make sure we can show them our appreciation. Thank you for your time.
Kent Ervin, past president, Nevada Faculty Alliance, for the record, K-E-N-T-E-R-V-I-N. Our faculty deserve their full COLAs, having suffered through years of salary stagnation along with other state employees. The 12% plus 11% COLAs are a historic opportunity to turn the corner on the long-term underfunding of faculty salaries and to become competitive for recruitment and retention. If we don't get to 11% in FY 2025, there will be little chance of making the COLAs up in future years, making a permanent cut. I hear concerns about future budget years if the full COLA is approved. The opposite is a more likely scenario. If ENSHE does not fully fund the COLAs, legislators will perceive that ENSHE doesn't really prioritize COLAs for faculty and will feel free to cut back further in the future. It's distressing to hear messaging that the COLAs will cause hiring freezes or elimination of positions. I object to the scapegoating of faculty COLAs for budget issues that have other contributing causes. As is often stated, to understand an organization's priorities, you have to look where they put their money. We saw 14.8% average salary increases for ENSHE executives and 8.7% for top-level administrators in a year during the pandemic budget cuts versus 3.9% for academic faculty. In FY 22 and 23, the institutions gave out ad hoc raises totaling $9.6 million, the majority of administrators. It's time for rank-and-file faculty to be made whole. Faculty can be flexible, as President New mentioned, but it's absolutely essential that the full 11% adjustments happen before the end of fiscal year 2025 and are included in future base salaries. Faculty should not be treated as second-class citizens and employees. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Brooks, Vice Chair Ariscotta, Regents, and Chancellor. I am Peter Reed, R-E-E-D. I serve as Chair of the Faculty Senate at the University of Nevada, Reno, and Chair of the ENSHE Council of Senate Chairs. I have two comments today. My first comment is that I encourage you to learn about and embrace faculty perspectives in your consideration of the FY25 COLA. I assure you that there are a wide range of views and many creative and potentially helpful ideas that are emerging. Faculty senates across the state, which represent all ENSHE faculty, have been working hard to gather feedback from faculty to inform your decision. Some have conducted campus-wide surveys, while others, such as my university, are hosting campus-wide conversations to promote engagement on the topic. The results of these efforts will be shared through faculty representatives on the committee you have convened to offer guidance on this important decision. Thank you for valuing the input of faculty across the system as you make this decision. My second comment is that I hope each of you was able to review the statement sent by the Council of Faculty Senate Chairs. While we commend you for seeking opportunities to learn about effective approaches to governance, we feel strongly that the Martin Center is an inappropriate resource to employ toward that goal. The Martin Center is very clearly misaligned with the deeply held core values of our system, including our system's strong support for diversity, equity, and inclusion activities, as well as its commitment to a shared governance approach that embraces and respects the important role and expertise of faculty. Honestly, engaging the Martin Center is a mistake that can be avoided. It would be much less controversial to use internal experts or even an outside nonpartisan consultant rather than a group that will take advantage of your interest in learning and growing as a board to promote their own political agenda. I urge you to reconsider that decision. Thank you.
I am Todd Rucker, T-O-D-D-R-U-E-C-K-E-R, and I serve as faculty senator for the College of Liberal Arts. I'm on the Faculty Senate Executive Board, and I'm also president of our local NFA chapter. CLA senators surveyed our faculty, letting them know about budgetary implications and possible position cuts, and they still overwhelmingly support the full COLA. Threads interspersed in a number of comments included criticism of the legislature's decision to underfund the COLAs, especially for research institutions, administration's budgetary priorities, and our college's plan to cut adjunct pay by 30% to balance the budget. Retention concerns were prevalent in a number of responses. One constituent wrote, "I am new to UNR and to the state. Had I known that it was run this badly, I would not have accepted my position." Another said, "Absolutely full COLA should be the only response. That this is even a topic of conversation when the university is investing in buildings rather than ensuring the success of current and future faculty is painful. I have a deep sense of gloom and am actively seeking other employment opportunities." On the other hand, despite other morale issues that have cropped up with implementation, COLAs are making a difference. One wrote, "Prior to the announcement and implementation of the COLA, I was looking for a job at a different institution." Given that all other state workers are receiving large COLAs this year and next, faculty are concerned that there may be minimal to no COLAs in the next biennium, so many of us think this 11% is carrying us through the next 3 years. Faculty in our college tend to be the lowest paid on campus. Our newest teaching faculty hires, all of whom have terminal degrees, started at under $60,000 and were not eligible for the most recent COLA. I urge you to consider a variety of strategies, including raising revenue, delaying COLAs, and ensuring that student fees are going to support instruction to find a way to the 11%. Without appropriately funding higher education, we are going to lose more faculty, have to increase class sizes and decrease offerings, and depend more fully on part-time hires, all of which will diminish the student experience. Thank you.
It looks like that might conclude public comment there. Thank you. Is there any public comment here in Las Vegas?
You know these microphones and I are dire enemies. Good morning, Bill Robinson, chair of the UNLV Faculty Senate and a member of the committee with Regent Carvalho looking at these. I want to just say a couple quick things. One is we need to remember that there are three parts here to the budget situation, that all of our campuses had budget gaps without considering the COLAs. And there's very rarely on our campuses do we hear that discussed. What we hear is that these COLAs are killing us. And we need what I asked for our committee was a breakout so that we could see the financials of the budget situation of the campus independent of the COLAs. We could see what was done to implement the 12% COLA, and then we had could look at what proposed we could come up with to do the 11%, and we would have an actual context of the big picture of what's going on across our institutions. And I'm hoping that the board, when you consider our recommendation, whatever that may be, will also want to take and look at the financial status of the campus as independent and how the 12% and what happened on the 11, so that we're not saying faculty or this salaries are doing this or we understand the whole context of what we're doing. I also want to remind you really quick that UNLV's general fund budget this year is the same as it was in 2009, that everything that's happened in the last 15 years in the system, which is good stuff, right? We got R1 rating, and then our, you know, shortly thereafter, our little sister in the north got their R1. They're our little sister in the north. All of that has happened on the pockets of the students and the pockets in the backs of the faculty. All of it, because the state has funded none of it. And so as we look at this, we need to understand that replacing us is way more expensive than keeping us and rewarding us for what we do and watching out for our students and making sure we don't do wrong by them. Thanks.
Good morning. Doug Unger, D-O-U-G, U-N-G-E-R, President, UNLV Chapter, Nevada Faculty Alliance. Thanks and appreciation to the Regents for your thoughtful and hopefully forward-looking consideration of agenda item number 3, discussion of possible 11% COLA raises for FY25. NG faculty and professionals deserve the same full 11% salary increase as all other Nevada State employees, no matter what this takes. We are aware that the full 11% may be difficult for our institutions to manage. Nonetheless, the more than 26% salary hole compared to peer institutions before last year's 12% COLA increase resulted from 14 years of little to no advance planning for compensation, compounded by distressing state policies that, in years of budget shortfalls, subjected us to salary freezes and furloughs. Even with the 12% COLA raise this year, our salaries are still only approximately 81% of the purchasing power of compensation in 2009, before the Great Recession. The additional 11% will bring pay up to approximately 87% of what we formerly earned, levels competitive with top-tier colleges and universities across the nation. Performance is directly related to compensation. The highest possible performance is what we're all working hard to achieve for the benefit of our students. In expressing my hope for forward-looking action beyond this current crisis, we ask the interim chancellor and regents to restore regular requests to the governor and legislature for the 2.5% of the total NG budget as a merit pool, the usual allocation for 3 decades before the 2008 economic crisis. Thank you for considering this or some other regular salary increase provision for the next NG budget, so faculty and professional compensation never falls into another deep hole again. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Maria Shellhase. I am a professor as well as department chair within the Business Administration Department at CSN. From my perspective, the Board of Regents should not be forced to reach consensus about awarding the community college academic faculty an additional 11% COLA increase. Even with the 12% COLA increase, thank you very much, Regents, the recruiting and retaining of CC academic faculty is a challenging task. The community college faculty salary schedule needs updating. The community college faculty schedule has not been adjusted in 10 years, and the COLAs received over the past 10 years has not been added to the schedule. The community college faculty starting pay is behind by approximately 31%, and that's NG-approved COLAs. From my perspective, faculty are easily replaced and are not valued. Why are there different rules and treatment for various groups within the college? For example, why did administrators receive substantial pay increases of approximately 30% without special Board of Regent meeting, all the while telling CC academic faculty there was no money in the budget to finally make them whole? Unfortunately, many CSN faculty are living paycheck to paycheck at a time when inflation has risen exponentially. And unfortunately, this has resulted in about 33% of academic faculty engaging in outside employment. Awarding the 11% increase will demonstrate your commitment to recruiting and retaining faculty who are educating students day in and day out. Pay for the increase by decreasing the number of administrators, which has increased at CSN by approximately 30 positions in 2023. Department budgets have been substantially cut, and departments are running on a shoestring. Is it ethical to award an additional 11% increase to administrators at the expense of instructional needs? Thank you for considering my point of view, and most importantly, thank you for your service.
Hi, my name is Stacey Walters. I'm tenured faculty at CSN and NFA bargaining chair. I'm here to speak on agenda item number 3, fiscal year 25 salary increases. The financial exposure to CSN for an 11% COLA increase for all is projected at $3.7 million after the legislature's 2-to-1 match, or 68%. CSN faculty have fallen way behind in salary. They were excluded from INSEE's equity study, and the 10-year starting salary chart has shown 0% increase for all grades of new hires. We continually lose faculty because of low starting pay, minimal salary raises, COLAs that do not increase with inflation rates, and an extremely low initial salary schedule. Did you know CSN's starting salary for bachelor degree holders is more than 10,000 below CCSDs? Ours starts at 41,000, which devastates faculty retention and morale. CSN claims that they have no funds. However, CSN created 27 new management positions this year and gave them raises. This year alone cost CSN $5.5 million more in admin salaries. Meanwhile, CSN claims that budget deficits are due to moving capacity positions, largely management and multi-campus positions, to HERF funding. HERF funding was not meant to cover management positions created during high enrollment periods. And deficits are due to an overly costly IT contract with Synoptic, which was supposed to be reviewed, but never has. Moving in-house would save millions of dollars. To pay for this, faculty are facing low and no salary increases, hiring freezes, severe cuts to departmental budgets. CSN cuts instruction and student support funds to fund management positions. CSN needs your support to direct HERF funds to faculty and students and to support the 2-to-1 COLA match offered by the legislature. The legislature values education. INSEE, the Regents, and our institutions of higher ed should value student instruction also. Vote for 11% COLAs for community college faculty and all faculty. Support equity. We can't afford to fall further behind.
My name is Pete Martini, M-A-R-T-I-N-I. I'm Nevada State faculty and local NFA chapter president. I'm speaking today to urge the Board of Regents to approve the 11% COLA for administrative and academic faculty. As I said the last time I stood before you, COLAs are not raises. Absent promotion, no NSHE faculty makes more today in real dollars than they did 2 years ago. Our salaries have been eroded by inflation. That erosion caused many of our colleagues to leave NSHE and higher education. We cannot find nursing faculty. We cannot find clinical psychology faculty. We cannot find these folks because they make so much more money in the private sector or working for local government institutions than they do working for us. Outside academia, in the last 2 years, I've served on several search committees, and I can tell you our search pools are drying up. We cannot find individuals in multiple departments, and multiple searches are going unfilled. The salaries and raises that we have in NSHE are so far from competitive that most of us don't make a livable wage in the areas we live in. The product our institutions provide is education, not shiny buildings, not naming rights, not new arenas, but education. What happens to that product and the number of people who seek it out if we don't have and can't keep outstanding faculty? Faculty drive education, but unfortunately, we're being driven out of this profession. I'll leave you with this thought. Without quality faculty creating quality programming, how much sooner will the enrollment cliff hit NSHE? Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Chantel Marshall, M-A-R-S-H-A-L-L for the record. I'm the Vice President of the Nevada Faculty Alliance. The last couple weeks in the world have been really hard. If you're anything like me, who pays probably too much attention to the news, but also who studies things like dehumanization and the psychology of these kinds of events, it's been really tough. And it can sometimes make it seem like the decisions we're making in these spaces are not as important. Maybe they're minimal compared to what's happening out in the world. But I'm here to remind you that the decision for COLA is really important because the goal, as my colleague Dr. Martini just mentioned, is the education of our students. It is of utmost importance that they walk out of our institutions understanding how to assess information in a world where it is an avalanche at every turn. It is the most important skill to have right now. And the way to ensure that they are walking out with that is to keep quality faculty. You can't give us a pay cut and expect us to continue doing the job that we're doing. We love it, but we're not martyrs. So I'm encouraging you to vote when it comes time for a full 11% COLA at some point in FY25. Even though the state legislature did not fund it completely, I doubt that we will have an opportunity like this in the future. And as we've already seen in years past, it simply compounds. We will lose faculty. We will not be able to gain new faculty who have the expertise and the skill set to actually teach our students and conduct the research that is needed to understand our world. So that said, I'd like to thank the committee, who I know has worked really hard on the various options of what this would look like. I know it's complicated and it's hard. So I'd like to thank the presidents for all of their hard work on that. And of course, the board for your service. Thank you.
Good morning. Good morning. My name is Carla Wright. I'm a registered nurse, and I've taught in the nursing department at the College of Southern Nevada for over 20 years. I live in Regent District number 6, right on the edge of number District 3. I'm here today to ask you to please support a scenario that would ensure an 11% COLA increase for fiscal year 25 for all academic faculty at CSN. It's very difficult to retain faculty at CSN because our salaries have not kept pace with inflation. The recent COLA adjustment was a much appreciated step in the right direction, and we thank you for that. But unfortunately, it was not enough, and it was not applied to the already outdated CSN initial salary bands. According to the Nevada Hospital Association, the average salary for a registered nurse is $89,700, and that's a registered nurse with an associate's degree. Yet, a nurse with 10 years' experience and a master's degree that's required to teach future nurses would only be offered $59,700 if they were hired to teach at CSN today, $30,000 less than an average nurse's salary, and $30,000 less than is being offered by the non-NSHE institutions who regularly poach our faculty because their salaries have kept up with inflation and industry standards. An 11% COLA is another giant step in the right direction to correct this disparity. Please support a scenario that will ensure an 11% COLA increase for all CSN faculty in fiscal year 25. Thank you.
I'm Sherry Lyman, professor at CSN, SHARILYMAN. I'm here to actually concur with all the COLA issues about keeping excellent faculty, but my issue is not an agenda item, and I do want to address my concerns about the CSN tenure process. As a faculty member, a faculty advocate, former NFA chapter and state officer, I've been involved with tenure applicants at CSN for years, and many have been discriminated against and retaliated against without cause by individuals who violate the tenure policy to suit their own desired outcome. I've supported and fought for tenure candidates who earned over 3 years of teaching and service to the college and service to the community, excellent faculty evaluations, only to be sabotaged as they start the tenure application process. Unfortunately, I thought this problem was being corrected back when I was going through the tenure process. But as we know, that was couple decades later, we're still in the same problem. Reasons for leadership, administration, trying to deny tenure to excellent faculty have many diverse reasons, and main reason seems to be professional jealousy. And we need to make sure that we apply the tenure policy, which is clear, and it constitutes success in the tenure process, as much as possible. Because even without the COLA, we're losing excellent faculty. So we need both. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Patrick Villa, V-I-L-L-A. I'm the Faculty Senate Chairperson at CSN. As with Bill, I'm also a member of the committee that met yesterday to talk about these 11% COLA raises, all that. One thing I wanted to ask the board to consider, when you do make the decision, I'd ask you to request information from the various institution HRs. Ask them over the last few years, how many times has the first choice candidate in a faculty search accepted the job or turned it down? And they don't always know it's because of salary, but anecdotally, I know we have gone third, fourth, fifth, sixth choice when looking for a new tenured faculty member. And as we all know, we want quality. We want the best. And it's very unfortunate when we are not getting the one that we would like because they get the salary offer and they basically balk and they walk away. And it's not a good thing. We have, as we've heard from all the colleagues here, people are leaving for the salary reasons. And every time we have a failed search, every time someone leaves, we have to conduct a search. And like the searches you guys have to do, not as big as that, but they take time, they take manpower, they eat up hours where we all could be spending more time worrying about our students, our classes, and all that. We're all happy to serve, but there's a point where we do get tired of doing this again and again and again, and the reason is because the salary is just not even close to what they should be getting. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for all the public comment. We'll now move on to agenda item number 2, which is our minutes. Is there a motion to approve the minutes from the August 29th, 2023 special meeting?
So moved by Regent Brager.
Is there a second?
Second.
Was that Regent Tarkanian? So we have a motion to approve by Regent Brager for the approval of the minutes from the August 29th, 2023 special meeting, seconded by Regent Tarkanian. Is there any discussion? Those all in favor of approving the motion, please signify by saying aye or yes.
Aye.
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 Those who disapprove, signify by saying no or nay. The motion passes. We'll move on to agenda item number 3. And the agenda item number 3 is the update on the committee to recommend board action for the FY 2025 salary increase. I'll call on interim, Chris Vitan, who will lead this discussion. Thank you very much for being here. There we go.
Good morning. I'm Chris Vitone. I'm your new Chief Financial Officer, and on behalf of former Acting Chief CFO Lindsay Sessions, it's my pleasure to provide this update on the work of the Chancellor's Committee to make a recommendation on fiscal year 25 salary increases. Before his departure, former Chancellor Arciaga established the committee to recommend board action on the fiscal year 25 salary increases. In September, Interim Chancellor Charlton, in consultation with the Council of Presidents, Student Leadership, and Faculty Senates, established the committee and the charge. Membership of the committee includes representation from university and community college student leadership, presidents, faculty senates, and includes the chair of the Business and Finance and Facilities Committee, Regent Carvalho, former acting and current NCCFO, myself, and Interim Chancellor Charlton. The committee is charged with evaluating the scenarios initially provided by the Business Officers Council in order to make a recommendation to the Chancellor for forwarding to the regions for consideration at your November 30th, December 1st meeting. As a part of their recommendation, the committee may recommend a student fee increase, such as the surcharge last utilized at the onset of the COVID pandemic, or an increase in registration fees as an update to the predictable pricing model as contemplated in the board's registration fee policy, which allows for adjustments to the predictable pricing model in case of emergency or extreme circumstances. In addition, the committee may make recommendations regarding a system-wide budget reductions or other strategies to offset the expense of salary increases supported by institutions' plans to address the expected fiscal impact. In this regard, the committee added additional items to be considered, including recommendations regarding the distribution of campus retained fees, suspension of the 1% performance pool, delayed implementation of fiscal year 25 cost of living increases, or any other items the committee considers appropriate. The committee's deliberation of the scenarios provided by the business officers has been robust, and as you're familiar from your own discussions and deliberations regarding the July 1st, 2023 cost of living adjustments, this is a complex issue, and there's not an easy solution. With an estimated cost of living, with an estimated shortfall of approximately $63 million system-wide for the state-supported budgets, all solutions will require some level of sacrifice, and the committee is keenly aware of the input that's been provided by their constituencies. The committee membership was established on September 18th, had its first meeting on September 29th, at second meeting yesterday, October 19th, and the committee's final meeting scheduled for next week, October 25th. I know faculty, staff, and the board are very anxious for the committee to complete its work, which was a heavy lift given this timeline. All involved are committed to completing the work on time to be able to make the recommendation and present it at your November 30th, December 1st meeting. I'd pause here. Having started my new role on just Monday, I'd like to acknowledge former acting CFO Lindsay Sessions and thank her for her work supporting the committee and to me during my transition to system administration. I want to offer Lindsay the opportunity to say a few words if she'd like. I think she's in Reno. If not, that would conclude my report. Thank you. Lindsay, are you with us?
Good morning. I'm here. I have nothing to add. Chris did a great job. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Chris, I'd like to acknowledge a misstep that I had in the beginning of this agenda, and that was not properly welcoming you to the system. We recognize that you just began. We appreciate all of the work and the endeavors that you're about to take on. So I want to say thank you very much for being here and doing the fantastic work that you're going to be doing. Are there any regents who have questions or comments for our new chief financial officer? I guess you hit it out of the park. Thank you very much. We appreciate the report. Thank you. We'll move on to agenda item number 4. Which is the overview of the United States Supreme Court's decision in Students for Fair Admissions. And I will call on our Associate General Counsel, Linda King, to provide information.
Thank you, Chair Brooks. Hello, everybody. It's nice to see everyone. For the record, Linda King, Associate General Counsel. So as the chair stated, this item is an overview of the Supreme Court decision in Students for Fair Admission, Inc. versus Presidents and Fellows of Harvard College. This is just an overview, and I think it's really important to highlight that this is a very vast and important issue and a very vast and important topic. And we're treating it in the context of a highlight. But I just want to invite any of the regents who have any additional questions or who want to delve into the court opinion or the reasoning in the court opinion in deeper, you know, conversation, please reach out. We're happy to do that. The reason we're having an overview is because ENCHI policy is in compliance with the court decision. So when the court decision came out, there were no changes that needed to be made
to the admissions practices at our institutions. But I just wanted to highlight the importance. There are, you know, I'm going to talk a lot about our policy. I'm going to actually read it to you all. so really some important points there. But this is, I will give you also an overview of the policies that were before the United States Supreme Court so that you can kind of see the differences and understand what the court was looking at. So with that said, I've already prefaced that our NG institutions are in compliance with the decision, which was rendered on June 29th of this year in the case of Students for Fair Admission versus Harvard College. There was also a companion case of Students for Fair Admission against the University of North Carolina. The court found that the affirmative action admissions policies of both Harvard, as we know, a private university, and the University of North Carolina, a public university, were unconstitutional. They did so on the basis of Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, and national origin in programs and activities receiving federal financial assistance. So that's how the court, through Title VI, that's how the court reaches the private institutions. Through the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, which prohibits a state from denying to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. And so through the Equal Protection Clause is how the court reaches both public and private institutions. The policies at Harvard and UNC were both what the court calls and what's known in this area of law as race-conscious policies. And that means that race of an applicant is considered as a factor in the admissions process. So at Harvard and UNC, race acted as either a tip or a plus in the admissions process. And so I'm going to give you just a short description of each. Harvard utilized a whole person review of applicants in which race was one of many factors considered during the admissions evaluation. Specifically, Harvard used a tip system which awarded tips, which is a rating from 1 to 6, in a variety of categories, which were plus factors that could tip an applicant into an admitted class. So Harvard gathered information, they had a group of tentatively admitted applicants, and then these tips could tip you into actually being admitted into Harvard. And one of the tips was considering an individual's race. Under the program, Asian Americans received the lowest scores on a personal rating category, despite having the highest scores for academics and extracurriculars. So as a result, Students for Fair Admission, which is a nonprofit organization, claimed systematic discrimination against Asian Americans in violation of Title VI. UNC had a similar admissions process, where they conducted what they called a holistic review of each student as an individual. Race and ethnicity were considered one factor among many, giving certain applicants a plus that tipped the balance of the individual toward admissions. Because UNC is a public institution, there, Students for Fair Admission asserted claims under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, claiming that UNC discriminated on the basis of race. The court agreed. We know that the decision came out. The court agreed, and I think the simplest statement that I can use to express, to pull from the case and express what the majority's reasoning was, and the opinion was written by Chief Justice Roberts. They said, eliminating racial discrimination means eliminating all of it. So the general rule from the case is that colleges and universities may no longer use race itself, race alone, as a factor in admissions processes. So it's a 200-page opinion with the majority opinion, all of the concurring opinions, and the dissenting opinions, of course, where the court doesn't expressly overrule all of its prior cases. So it still applies the tests that are quite complex under constitutional law to evaluate the case. But effectively, and I think any article that any of us can find and read about this case, is that it has eliminated affirmative action in admissions without expressly overruling the prior cases of the court. So universities and colleges can still have the goal of achieving the educational benefits of diversity, but they're limited by the means in which they can do so. So the court left a very narrow pathway forward in the majority opinion, where it says that institutions may consider an applicant's discussion of how race has affected that applicant's life, be it through discrimination, inspiration, or otherwise, provided that that discussion is concretely tied to the applicant's character or unique abilities. And a quote from the case that supports that idea and that concept from the Chief Justice is that a student must be treated based on his or her experiences as an individual, not on the basis of race. So as I mentioned before, ENCHI policy is already in compliance with this decision. The ENCHI institutions do not consider race as a factor in the admissions process. And it's really important that we remember this is the very limited context, and the court decision was in the limited context of admissions. I'm going to talk a bit about what the broader implications of that might be, which are unknown at this point, but it's important for us to know right now it's had no impact on our students for admissions. And that is because the board's policy at Title IV, Chapter 8, right in the introduction says, the Nevada system of higher education is guided by the principle that there shall be no difference in the treatment of persons because of race, and it goes on to list other protected categories, and that equal opportunity and access to facilities shall be available to all. And as you skip down, it talks more about, your policy talks more about this principle, stating that the principle governs the admission and subsequent treatment of students in all institutions, as well as student participation in extracurricular activities. Also, it reaches into the employment of students by stating that it is a guiding policy in the employment of students, either by ENCHI or by outsiders through the system, that all student services, including financial aid, placement, tutoring, and counseling, are governed by the concept of equal opportunity. So the policy covers the context of admissions. Race will not be and other protected classes cannot be utilized as a factor. And it also extends this to the treatment of our students in other contexts and other programs and activities that they might undertake at our institutions. So when the court decision came out, we had a really amazing collaboration with all of the student affairs groups at the system. There were immediate questions, immediate sharing of resources, and everyone was waiting for the Department of Education to come out with guidance. And they did. The court decision was at the end of June, and in August, we had a letter from the Biden administration, and that letter states, the president and vice president call on colleges, universities, and other stakeholders to seize the opportunity to expand access, an educational opportunity for all students, and to build diverse student bodies, including by recognizing and valuing students who have overcome adversity. So the administration and various federal agencies have made similar statements. And our presidents at our institutions were very quick in affirming to their students and their campus communities that regardless of the decision, there were no changes on campus, and everyone was going to hold steadfast to the mission and goals of diversity and inclusivity on our campuses. And so those messages came out very timely. They came out much quicker than the president's letter. And so what the president said is in order to help institutions of higher education, he's going to have the Department of Education and the Department of Justice issue question and answer format guidelines. So that letter and the question and answer format guidelines were all included in your briefing papers. These are instructive and these are helpful guides for institutions of higher education that have a policy that was not in compliance with the Supreme Court decision. I think that it is helpful for our institutions as it reinforces some of the ways that we can continue to enforce the mission and the goals of inclusivity, access, through our pathways and pipelines, through our recruitment efforts, and through our retention efforts. So I got a little far afield in my notes. Let me take a look. One of the areas that the guidance looks at first is scholarships and financial aid. Again, this is not an issue for NG institutions, where our legal offices and our foundations are already looking at donor intent. If they consider that there's going to be a violation of policy, they work with the donor to finesse the language, retain that gift and make it so that it's applicable, or make it so that it's in compliance with our policy. What we know is that there's going to be future litigation. So right now we can look at the institution's admissions practices and we can continue to assist and support and encourage the institutions to maintain their commitment to diversity, which was the goal of Harvard and UNC and all other institutions that had that were using race as a factor in admissions. Their goal was diversity. That was the interest that they were trying to achieve. And if you look at NSHE's policy, we were spot on with that as well. Because Section 3 of Chapter 8 states the general policy of the Board of Regents on recruitment, admission, and retention of students. And it says, in short, it is the responsibility of the Board of Regents and the officers and employees of the Nevada System of Higher Education to help diversify our society and establish social justice by actively taking measures to ensure that the growing population of minority groups, women, and other protected classes are prepared to participate fully in the life of our state and our nation, and that our officers and employees should be taking active steps to recruit and retain students from these groups in the post-secondary educational programs of the NSHE. So again, not too many changes for us as an impact of this case. But there are many, many resources out there in addition to the Department of Education guidance. The American Council on Education has materials. There are associations, groups, law firms. There's an abundance of resources right now, many of which state this uncertainty about what's going to happen with the future cases and future litigation. How will it define the scope of the reasoning that the court adopted in the Harvard case? And one example of that is with legacy admissions. This is something that Regent McMichael brought to the board's attention and had asked for us to take a look at. We don't have that as a factor at our institutions right now, but this is an important question. The Office of Civil Rights has received a complaint against Harvard that the use of legacy or preference or donor preference, so this would be an admissions preference to the children of donors or alumni, and at Harvard, I think it is 70% of the legacy applicants that apply are admitted, and they have a 6% greater chance of being admitted. So that the Office of Civil Rights is investigating right now at Harvard, so we should expect either a resolution that comes out of that case and potential litigation that comes out of that case. Only 6% of public institutions have legacy preferences, so this is really something that applies in the world of private institutions and elite Ivy League schools, but it's something that our policy doesn't address. So it's an area that we could look at, but it's not a practice that's being instituted at NSHE right now, and I think that's probably on the forefront of what's coming in litigation. But as far as our institutions that use open enrollment, so they don't have an admissions issue, the guidance tells us that they can continue to look at and collect data. So you can still ask an applicant what their ethnicity is or what their race is. And those are important, especially important data points for our institutions that are minority and Hispanic serving institutions. So like I said, we've got an amazing collaboration everyone is keeping an eye on this at all of the institutions. And I know that our IDEA Council is also very actively involved. And Dr. Sandra Cosgrove came and spoke at an IDEA committee meeting, I believe it was in August, and spoke a little bit about the case and, you know, was spot on everything that she presented. And that was a great presentation. So I know that that committee is actively engaged as well. So with that, I'll see if anyone has any questions about the case.
Mr. Chair.
Regent Borland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. King, thank you so much for that presentation. I have a simple question, I think. So how does this apply to admissions based on race for Native Americans who are given admission based on their race so that they don't have to pay any, you know, admission fees, etc.? That's just help me with that. Isn't that based on race?
No.
And that's admissions? No.
No, no. The OCR does not base or treat the Native American. I think you're referring to the tuition waiver. They do not view that.
Yes,
they do not view that under the lens of race.
Yeah, but they get the tuition waiver under the lens of race, so it helps them in their admissions.
Yeah, from a legal perspective.
See
a legal,
what I'm saying?
I do. I understand from a legal perspective, and I can provide you some additional analysis, because this is really a legal construct. From a legal lens, that's not viewed as race, as a factor of race.
So what we've just been told, and what's in our entry policy, we don't base admissions on race, but we do base admissions on race.
No.
When it comes to Native Americans, no.
No.
No. Well, I won't belabor the point, but
the tuition. Well, no, I want to, because it's that you just you. I think we're conflating issues. The issue of admissions. None of our institutions would be looking at whether or not an applicant is a Native American. When we go to look at the residency requirements and what registration fees are going to be charged, then that's a separate category. And in looking at that under the tuition, let's call it the tuition umbrella, the Office of Civil Rights, which and the Department of Justice, which is the enforcement arm, does not look at the category of Native American as race. So it's sort of a non-issue to the point that you raise. But I'd want to make that distinction between admissions and then the payment of the fees once the student is admitted and enrolled. Okay.
Thank you so much, ma'am. Appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Thank you, sir.
Are there any other questions or comments regarding the presentation? Amy. Regent Carvalho, Regent Del Carlo, whichever wants to go first. You both said it at the same time.
Thank you. I just want to thank you for the presentation. I know I've been asked questions about this, and I knew it didn't affect us in Nevada. But I enjoyed reading through it, so I have a better scope because I deal with other states. So thank you.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to say thank you for that presentation. I know that this decision has garnered a lot of attention in the world of higher education, and I wrote down a few things, and I've got a few things here, but. I want to thank both our legal team and our IDEA committee and council for your attention to this. As you said, it's an ongoing issue that we'll have to monitor. But I am really proud of the diverse and inclusive policies that the system that we have here at ENSHE institutions. Public colleges and universities are made to be places where democratic, equitable, and diverse thought can thrive. And I'm glad that the Supreme Court decision has not undermined our foundation and mission here at ENSHE. I want to make clear that there's no question that I stand for diversity, equity, and inclusion in attracting and retaining students and employees at ENSHE, and I stand for academic freedom and shared governance. And I think sometimes we are under attack by a lot of external forces, and I think it's important for us to remain true to that foundation and to be sure that that we, first of all, mirror the communities that our institutions are in, and that we are a place where all thought and diversity of all people can feel welcome. So thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions. Thank you very much for the presentation. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now move on to new business. Are there any suggested items for consideration of new business? I don't see any items for new business.
Chair Brooks.
Go ahead.
This is Jeff Downs.
Go ahead, Regent Downs.
Thank you. Just going on, going forward with new business, I'd like to, over the next few months, start looking at the student enrollment process from application to actually enrolling in classes, and seeing what can be done to make that process go more smoothly for students. I've had some conversations with the chancellor about this, and it'd be nice to, if actually all the board could have the experience of applying for admissions and trying to enroll in classes, if there's a way to make that happen. So that's an agenda item I think would be beneficial for us to see how this works so that we can try to improve our students' processes. Thank you.
Are there any other regents with new business items? Seeing none, we'll move on to agenda item number 6, which is public comment. Is there any public comment at GBC?
There's no public comment at GBC.
Is there any public comment at the system office in Reno?
Yes.
Good morning, Kent Irvin, ERVIN. Thank you so much for your discussion of the COLAs and the work of the COLA committee. I would like to address a narrative about the underfunding of COLAs and do it from the point of view of the state legislature so we can understand where they're coming from. From the legislator's point of view, they funded 100% of the faculty COLAs for the state general funded portion of ENSHE's budget. Now, that's 100% of the 65% in the state allocated budgets. So it is less than the 80% COLA pool for state agencies that only have state funded, but other state agencies that have both state and non-state funded revenue sources are treated the same way. The remainder between 80% and 100% is expected for all state agencies to come from salary savings due to turnover and vacancies and other reserves and or from non-state revenue sources. Now, for ENSHE, that mainly means student registration fees for the instructional budgets. That policy may have started as a mistake in 2019 compared to past practice, but it was made official in 2021 and continued by the legislature in 2023, despite support from Governor Lombardo to go back to the 80% formula for ENSHE. The number of $62 million for the FY 2025 COLA shortfall at ENSHE was mentioned today, but the difference between 80% that a fully state-funded agency would have gotten, and the 60% average for ENSHE is about $26 million. All state agencies, including ENSHE, would be expected to accommodate the 80% funding pool through regular budgeting practices, including regular vacancies and turnover. So at most, the differential amount between 80% and 66%, which is about $26 million, should be considered as needing shared sacrifice from students and faculty. Thank you.
I don't see any other public comment at the system office in Reno. Is there any public comment here in Las Vegas?
Hi, Nicole Thomas, UNLV GPSA PhD student in educational psychology. I didn't want to take up too much time at the beginning of the meeting, so I thought I could do it at the end, but I'm also a member of that salary committee. This is clearly going to be a very, very difficult decision, but I wanted to remind you all that our students wouldn't be here if it were not for the faculty. This is something that I do feel very strongly about. I struggled finding mentors when I was younger, and I always looked towards my teachers. That's something that has continued for me during college as well. The faculty members that have gotten me into grad school, the faculty members that have helped me with research, the ones that have helped me write publications. My parents didn't know how to do any of those things, but the faculty members did. So I ask that we pay them their fair share and that we try to retain them as best as possible with the COLA increase. I recognize that there will be a shared sacrifice between students and faculty, and that's something that I think we should continue to have discussions about. I know it's going to be a difficult decision, but I also understand that, you know, if I'm paying for something, I hope that they will provide things for me as well. So that's something that we will obviously discuss in December, but I did want to provide the student perspective of that. It's also homecoming week at UNLV. Yay! So I wanted to celebrate that with you all as well. So thank you for your time today. I appreciate you all and the work that you do.
Is there any public comment on the phone with SCS?
Not at this time.
Thank you. I'll just give one quick administrative note prior to adjourning the meeting, and that is that lunch is set up in the room across from where we are. We are going to be serving regents, the chancellor's cabinet, presidents, faculty, senate chairs, student body presidents, and then anybody else, please follow behind those folks if you're hungry and you'd like to eat here. The workshop will begin at noon. This meeting is now adjourned. Thank you.